Simon & Schuster Audio presents Code of Conduct by Brad Thor. Read by Armin Schulz.
If you must break the law, do it to seize power. Julius Caesar. Prologue. Washington, D.C. When word leaked that the president had been taken to Bethesda Naval Hospital for observation, panic set in. If the president of the United States wasn't safe from the virus, no one was. Scott Harvath swerved around the car in front of him and sped through the intersection as the light changed. The traffic was worsening. Quarantine rumors had sent people rushing to stores to stock up. "We don't need to do this," the woman sitting next to him said. What she meant was that he didn't need to do this. He could leave too. He didn't have to stay behind in D.C.
"I've already talked to John and his wife," he replied. "You'll be safe there."
"What about you?"
"I'll be okay. I'll join you as soon as I can."
He was lying. It was a white lie, meant to make her feel better, but it was a lie nonetheless. They were already talking about shutting down air traffic. That's why he needed to get her out tonight.
"What if we're overreacting?" she asked.
"We're not."
Lara knew he was right. She had seen the projections. Even the best case numbers were devastating. The cities would be the hardest hit. Hospitals were already at surge capacity and were being overrun by otherwise healthy people who had convinced themselves they were showing one or more of the symptoms. It was beginning to make it impossible for real emergencies, like heart attack and acute asthma sufferers, to be seen. And it was only going to get worse. Cities, towns, and villages from coast to coast scrambled to figure out how they would continue to deliver essential services, much less deal with a staggering number of bodies if the death toll reached even half of what was being predicted. In a word, they couldn't. As they succumbed to the virus or stayed home to protect their own families, fewer and fewer first responders would be available. Soon, 911 call centers would go down. After that, water treatment facilities and power plants. Hospitals, pharmacies, and grocery stores would have all long ceased operating, the majority of them looted and burned to the ground. Chaos and anarchy would reign. The only people who might hope to survive were those who had exercised some degree of caution and had prepared in advance. But even then, there was still no guarantee. Riding in the wake of death and his pale horse was another force that would prove just as devastating. Those who planned to take advantage of the chaos. Suddenly, two blue and white Department of Homeland Security Suburbans spun around the corner and came racing toward them, their lights and sirens blaring. Harvath jerked his wheel hard to the right to get out of their way. Even then, he came within inches of being hit before the DHS vehicles swerved back into their lane. Lara turned in her seat as they sped past.
"Jesus!" she exclaimed. "Did you see that? They almost hit us."
The chaos had officially started. Before he could respond, his cell phone rang.
"Good," he said, after listening to the voice on the other end. "We're 10 minutes away."
Disconnecting the call, he pressed harder on the accelerator and told her,
"The plane just landed. Everything will be ready by the time we get there."
Nearing the private aviation section of Reagan International, there was a sea of limousines and black town cars. He wasn't the only one who had seen the writing on the wall. Those who could get out were getting out now. Not wanting to get tied up in the parking lot, he pulled to the side of the road near the entrance and hopped out to get Lara's bag. Opening the rear of his Tahoe, he plugged his combination into one of the drawers of his truck vault and pulled it open.
"I already have my duty weapon," Lara said, "plus my credentials and extra ammo."
She was always armed. He knew that. Removing a small, hard-sided Pelican case, he handed it to her.
just in case, he said.
Lara popped the latches and flipped open the lid.
Sat phone?
She asked.
Harvath nodded. If this gets worse, the cell phone network won't stay up for long.
Is my cell even going to work up there?
Once you leave Anchorage, you might as well turn it off until you get to the lodge. There's no cell service there, but you can make calls over their Wi-Fi.
Removing the battery cover, he showed her where he had taped the number for the sat phone he kept in his bug-out bag. If everything failed, the sat phones would be their fallback. Closing up the Tahoe, he picked up her bag and walked with her to the signature flight support building. Inside, it was pandemonium. Wealthy families jostled with corporate executives to speed the departure of their jets. There were mountains of luggage and, from what he overheard, a vast array of destinations. Jackson Hole, Eleuthera, Costa Rica, Kauai, likely second or third home locations where they hoped to ride out the storm. Harvath spotted their co-pilot, who took Lara's bag and the Pelican case, and walked them out to the jet. Harvath didn't want a long goodbye. He wanted them in the air as quickly as possible. Wrapping his arms around her, he kissed her. It felt detached, distant. His mind had already left the airport. It was on to the dangerous assignment that lay in front of him.
It's still not too late, she said.
It was, and she knew it.
You need to get going, he replied,
giving her one more kiss as he broke off their hug.
See me onto the plane.
It was too loud on the tarmac to hear the chime, but he felt his phone vibrate in his pocket. Pulling it out, he read the message. Now he really needed to go.
I can't, he said, kissing her one last time. Let me know when you get there.
With that, he turned and walked back to the signature flight support building. As soon as he was inside, he called the person who had texted him.
Are you positive about this? He asked.
100%, the voice on the other end responded.
How long do I have?
Could be hours. Could be days. What are you going to do?
What would you do?
Harvath asked.
Get my affairs in order, and hope it's painless.
Chapter 1. Ituri Province, Democratic Republic of Congo, 1 week earlier. The heavy truck rolled through the early morning darkness. Mist clung to the damp jungle road. Scott Harvath pulled out his phone and watched the video again. How many times had he seen it now? 100? 200? It was shaky, and parts were out of focus. A team in biohazard suits could be seen going into a small medical clinic. Moments later, there were muzzle flashes and gunfire. Then, nothing. The footage had been emailed to CARE International, the U.S.-based charitable organization that had helped establish the clinic. The video quickly made its way to CARE's founder, businessman cum philanthropist Ben Beeman. Over the next several hours, Beeman tried to contact the Matumeni Clinic in eastern Congo. No one replied. Finally, he hit the panic button and reached out to the most senior person he knew at the State Department. But with no Americans at the clinic at the time, there was little the State Department could do. It was outside their mission, as his contact informed him. The man offered to make some calls on his behalf, but told Beeman not to get his hopes up. Beeman saw CARE as a family. An attack on one of them was an attack on all of them. He made no distinction whether the person was from Kinshasa or Kansas City. If the State Department wouldn't help, he'd have to look elsewhere. But where? Even if he knew someone there, the FBI and CIA were just as likely to say no. Some tiny African clinic in the middle of nowhere was outside everyone's mission, but there had to be someone who could help him, which had gotten him thinking. When one of his doctors had been kidnapped from the CARE hospital in Afghanistan, a particularly resourceful man had been hired to fly over and get her back. That was the kind of help he needed. It took Beeman several phone calls to track Scott Harvath down. He was working for a private intelligence company that didn't advertise. They didn't need to. The majority of the Carlton Group's work had previously been via black contracts through the Department of Defense. Now, though, they were finding themselves repeatedly tasked on covert operations by the White House and the Central Intelligence Agency. There had been a rough patch when the Carlton Group had no choice but to take anything that came their way, but that was in the past. They seldom took private assignments anymore. When they did, there had to be a compelling reason. Similar to Doctors Without Borders, CARE went where few dared, and even fewer wanted to go. From Mumbai to Mogadishu, they had set up shop in some of the worst poverty-stricken backwaters of the Third World. While there, CARE's Western volunteers not only treated locals, but helped local medical personnel improve their skills. They were good people who did good things for those in desperate need. The organization was also one that was no stranger to violence. Over the years, their facilities and personnel had experienced a handful of attacks. They took security seriously, but there was only so much they could afford to do. They wanted to use as much of their money as possible helping people. That was their mission. They had been planning to open 2 more clinics in Congo, but Beeman had put a temporary stop to those. Until they knew what had happened at the Matumeni clinic, they weren't moving on anything. While the U.S. government didn't like to use NGOs for covert operations, the Carlton Group's founder had a different view. He had a couple of relationships already, but nothing like CARE. Getting them into his back pocket could be invaluable. Even better, Beeman had offered to pay the Carlton Group a significant premium. It was a dangerous assignment, and Beeman appreciated the risks. He only had one stipulation. He wanted Scott Harvath leading the operation. Right out of the gate, they had a problem. Technically, Harvath wasn't available. He had been working at a furious tempo and had just come off a hellacious operation in Syria. Everything at home had been put on hold, and that included his relationship. She lived in Boston, and Harvath lived outside D.C., near Alexandria. The distance made things difficult enough. What was making it almost impossible, though, was how many times Harvath had rescheduled with her, or had left the country entirely without giving her any notice at all. She had asked him to put 1 week on the books, then set it in stone, wrap it in bulletproof Kevlar, and bury it under 50 feet of concrete. Harvath picked one, went to Carlton, had had him sprinkle holy water on the dates. The deal was done. They would take in New England's fall colors. She pulled strings at work to have the same week off. She rented the perfect cottage on the water and convinced the realtor to take delivery of 2 cases of their favorite wine. It would be a great surprise. They would stop at her favorite general store on the way and stock up on supplies. Once they arrived at the cottage, the wine would be there and they wouldn't have to leave for anything. The master bedroom had enormous windows and they could watch the colors peak from there. It was exactly what they needed. When Reed Carlton, or the old man as Harvath referred to him, called, he got right to the point. "You've got a meeting in the office tomorrow morning. Be here by 7:30. Wear a suit." Obviously, somebody important was coming in, but Carlton hadn't offered up any details. Typical. The old spy master never revealed more than he wanted anyone to know. Harvath didn't mind. He was used to it by now. He was also already half checked out, looking forward to a week away up in New England. The next morning, the 5'10" Harvath showed up at the Carlton Group's offices in Reston, Virginia, coffee in hand, wearing a coal gray Ralph Lauren suit, white shirt, and a dark blue tie. With only cardio for his workouts overseas, he had dropped about 10 pounds from his already fit frame. His blue eyes stood out against his tan skin, and his sandy brown hair appeared lighter. In the mirror that morning, he had looked more like a beach-going Southern California college student than a U.S. Navy SEAL turned covert counterterrorism operative. The old man was already in the conference room with their guest. Harvath stepped in and was introduced to Ben Beeman, the director of CARE International. After Harvath asked how the doctor he had rescued in Afghanistan was doing, Carlton invited everyone to take their seats and then steered the conversation to the matter at hand. Beeman had brought his laptop and ran both men through a quick PowerPoint about the Matoumeni Clinic. The slides included pictures of the facility, its staff, and the people they served, mostly families with children. The clinic's name came from the Swahili word for hope. It was deep in the jungle near the border with Uganda, the only medical facility for over 200 kilometers. It boasted 15 beds, an exam room that doubled as a laboratory, and a small dispensary. Beeman's final slide contained the video of the attack. He pushed the play button, and the three men watched. When it was over, Beeman closed his laptop and sat back in his chair. "That's all we know," he had said. The old man activated a flat screen beyond the conference table. On it, he explained, was recent satellite footage he had acquired. When he clicked a small wireless device, the image was magnified, coming to rest on a small clearing that had been hacked out of the dense jungle. In the center was Beeman's clinic. There was no sign of anyone anywhere near it. Carlton held up his index finger as if to say, "There's something else," and then drew their attention back to the screen. Manipulating the wireless device, he refocused the image, northwest of the clinic. There, they could see what looked like a long, scorched trench at the base of a hill. Tendrils of black smoke curled into the air from it. "Any idea what that is?" the old man asked. Beeman shook his head.
"Looks like a burn pit," Harvath replied. "A big one."
Carlton nodded. "I agree. Any thoughts on what they were burning?"
"I don't think it was trash."
Beeman looked from one man to the other, and the volume of his voice dropped.
"Do you think they were burning bodies?"
The old man switched off the satellite footage. "It could be anything."
"But what if it is bodies?" he replied. "What if those are women and children? Our staff and patients?"
He shifted his gaze to Harvath and asked,
"If it's not trash, what is it?"
Harvath had been to more war-ravaged areas than he cared to remember. He had seen things beyond horrible. The worth of a culture, in his opinion, could be boiled down to one thing: how well that culture took care of its weakest members, particularly its women and children. The satellite image of the burn pit brought back a flood of memories, none of them pleasant, none of them things he wanted to remember. Something about it, though, was odd. He tried to put his finger on it, and when he couldn't, he relegated it to the back of his mind.
"Mr. Carlton is right," Harvath conceded. "It could be anything."
For a moment, Beeman didn't know how to respond. "But we all agree it probably wasn't trash." Harvath looked to the old man, then back at Beeman, and nodded. An uncomfortable silence fell over the conference room. Finally, Beeman broke it. "Mr. Harvath, I want to find out what happened."
"Scratch that," he said, correcting himself. "I have to find out what happened. I owe it to those people, to all of my people. If this had happened to a team you were responsible for, I don't doubt that you'd feel the same way."
Harvath began to understand where this was headed. Beeman wanted him to lead the operation. If their places were reversed, of course Harvath would want to know what had happened to his team. But this wasn't about a team of his. This was about Beeman's people, and there was a lot more to this story. It wasn't as simple as flying over and figuring out what had happened. Congo was the world's deadliest conflict zone. 5.5 million dead in less than 20 years. Invasions from neighboring countries, wars, political instability. It was like a match factory, if match factories also stored buckets of gasoline and hung lit sparklers from the ceiling. Calling it unstable was too generous by half. The danger and instability of the region were just two of the many problems Harvath saw with this situation. There was also a host of unanswered questions. No one even knew who had sent the video to CARE, and worse still, no one could explain why the gunmen entering the clinic had been wearing biohazard suits. According to Beeman, Matumeini was a small family medicine clinic. They didn't treat highly communicable illnesses. They didn't have the capacity. The furthest they went was performing minor surgeries. If something exotic or unusual walked in their door, they knew to call for help. But as far as Beeman or anyone at CARE knew, no such call had gone out. Harvath didn't like any of it. He hated loose ends. There were too many things stacked one upon another that didn't make sense. Beeman was also running out of time. The longer it took to get a team over to Congo, the colder the trail would become. If something wasn't done soon, they might never know what happened and who was responsible. Once again, a rush of unpleasant images moved across the screen of his mind's eye. The scenes of families were the hardest to stomach. He had witnessed what monsters could do. He knew what monsters continued to do when not stopped. In this case, the monsters embodied an amplified evil. They had preyed not only on the sick and infirm, but also upon those who had helped to care for them. His mind then drifted to his trip to New England, but only as an afterthought. He had already decided what he was going to do, what he told himself he had to do. The Carlton Group didn't have anyone else who could take on this kind of assignment with so little advance warning. If he didn't agree to take charge, it wouldn't get done. The State Department had passed, and Beeman was right. The FBI and CIA weren't going to help him either. Harvath was CARE's only hope. It would be an absolute ballbuster of an assignment, and he would have to figure out a lot of it on the fly. But he knew he could do it, just like he knew he could convince Lara that he had no choice but to postpone their trip to New England. He would find leaves for her someplace else, someplace even better. It would all work out. And with his decision made, he had jumped in with both feet. Logistics, equipment, funds, support. It was chaos, but he relished the challenge because chaos was the arena in which he excelled. The old man had left him with one final directive. Get in and get the hell out as fast as you can. Within 24 hours, he was on the ground in the Democratic Republic of Congo. 12 hours later, he had assembled his team, and they were on their way north to the Matumeini Clinic. Exiting out of the video player, he took another look at his text message screen before returning the phone to his pocket and powering down the tiny iridium cube he used to access the satellite network. He had texted Lara when he had touched down to let her know that he had arrived safely. She had not responded, and Harvath tried to put it out of his mind. He needed to get his head in the game. If everything went according to plan, they would be in and out. At least, that's what he had told himself. He had also told himself that he'd be able to sway Lara about canceling, or as he had put it, rescheduling their trip. That had not gone over well with her at all. But Scott Harvath had a bad habit of telling himself things he knew weren't true. Chapter 2. Harvath's security team was made up of 4 Brits, all former SAS members. They had been with a private contracting company in Kenya called Ridgeback. There was too much money and too much action in Congo, though, so they left to form their own venture. They called their 4-man company Extremis. Harvath had never met any of them before, but they had come highly recommended. He had linked up with Patrick Asher and Mike Michelson in Lubumbashi, where they loaded their gear onto the plane CARE had arranged for them. Asher, or Ash, as his men referred to him, was the team leader. He was in his early 40s and reminded Harvath in a way of the old man. He was cordial, but all business. No jokes, no small talk, just straight to the point. His graying hair and dark eyes gave him an added air of intensity. Michelson, on the other hand, was different. Known by his teammates as Mick, he was a short, muscular man in his 30s, with a shaved head and a neck like a tree trunk. Everything amused him. Within the first 10 minutes of their having met, he had slapped Harvath on the back at least 3 times. After loading their equipment, they flew north to Bunia, the provincial capital of Ituri. Waiting for them were the other 2 members of the team, Simon Bruce and Evan Eddie Edwards. On the flight up, Mick had referred to Simon and Eddie as the Brute Squad. Meeting them, Harvath understood why. They were large men, both in their 30s, well over 6 feet tall and half a block wide. Unlike their clean-shaven compatriots from Lubumbashi, they sported facial hair, but not just any kind of facial hair. Simon had the biggest, reddest beard Harvath had ever seen. He looked like a lumberjack on steroids. Eddie sported a meticulous jet-black Van Dyke that made him look like he had just stepped out of a Captain Morgan ad. Congo was already living up to its Wild Wild West reputation. Accompanying Simon and Eddie was their fixer, a skinny young Congolese man they had nicknamed Jambo, which meant hello in Swahili. Because his real name was practically impossible for anyone to pronounce, and because of the manic enthusiasm with which he greeted people, the Jambo nickname had stuck. Two white Toyota Land Cruisers stood idling on the tarmac. One was outfitted for carrying passengers, the other for hauling cargo. Both had been tricked out with off-road packages that included lift kits, snorkels, winches, and mud tires. Like the fixer Ash had paid off in Lubumbashi, Jambo had made sure no Bunia airport personnel would interfere with them while they offloaded their gear into the vehicles. As the team transferred everything over, Harvath handed Ash the car door magnets Beeman had provided. They proclaimed in black and red letters on a white background that the vehicles were on official humanitarian business from CARE International. They even included little red crosses. There were stickers as well that showed AK-47s with X's through them, and these were placed in the vehicle windows as well. Once the gear was packed inside, tied down to the roof racks, and ready to roll, they left the airport and headed into the capital. Jambo had secured rooms for them at the best place in town, the 2-star Bunia Hotel. To its credit, it had high walls, a secure gate, beer, and a pool table. By Eastern Congo standards, it was the height of luxury. The kitchen even turned out halfway decent Chinese and Indian food, something Harvath hadn't expected. Even though the hotel's motor court was enclosed, Jambo had hired two of his relatives to spend the night with the vehicles. After checking in and moving the most sensitive of their gear to their rooms, the team reconvened in the lobby. Their first round of beers had just been served when the final member of the operation walked into the lobby. She was a tall blonde in a tight green t-shirt and even tighter gray REI hiking pants. A pair of Oakley sunglasses hung around her neck and dangled between her breasts. Her arms were buff, and she sported a healthy tan. Freckles formed an imperfect bridge over a perfect nose. Her eyes, even in the half-light of the lobby, were a piercing gimlet green. Unshouldering her pack, she had dropped it next to the pool table and introduced herself around to the team. Brash and unafraid, right from the jump. Before becoming a physician, Dr. Jessica Decker had been a war correspondent. She knew all too well what men were capable of doing to each other. Having seen enough suffering, particularly in Congo, she had decided she wanted to do more than just write about it. That's why she left journalism and had gone into medical school. She had been working with CARE for less than a year when she was asked to open the Matumeni Clinic on their behalf. She went on to carry out 3 subsequent missions there. She knew the area and its people better than anyone else. She was in the middle of opening one of CARE's 2 new clinics, a facility outside Kinshasa, when everything was put on hold. Beeman had thought she could be helpful in the current situation, and the old man had agreed. It had been 2-1, and Harvath was overruled. Decker, Carlton had decided, wouldn't only be coming along, but she could also be a part of their cover. Not even Ash and his team knew the full extent of what was going on. As far as they knew, they had been hired to accompany a load of medical supplies and 2 members of CARE International to a clinic in the Ituri province. It was dangerous territory, and the middleman for CARE claimed they had been robbed twice before en route. CARE wanted to make sure that didn't happen again. Ash had guaranteed that his team would do everything they could to make sure that didn't happen. He felt relatively confident this would be a sure thing. Then Harvath had stepped off the plane in Lubumbashi. The American had operator written all over him. Ash could tell right away that there was more to this assignment than he and his team had been told. Quietly, he passed the word to each of his men to be on their guard. When the woman arrived, the complication factor escalated. She was incredibly attractive. Too attractive for Congo, a rough place where people prized commodities above all else and would pay or do anything to get what they wanted. She didn't belong here, yet she had walked in like she owned the place. Already she was playing with them. The shirt that showed off her chest, the tight pants that hugged her ass, the careful application of makeup, just enough to make it look like she wasn't wearing any makeup at all. It all came together and spelled trouble. Ash was beginning to wonder if taking this assignment had been a mistake. Harvath didn't know what to think of Jessica Decker either. The woman who entered the hotel was certainly not what he had expected. Beeman had forwarded a care newsletter to him with a bland photo taken in the field. It certainly hadn't prepared him for what she looked like in real life. Not that it would have mattered much. The fact that she was here was just a reminder that he didn't have a say in the matter. After introducing herself around, she had walked over to the bar to order. Harvath fought the urge to watch her, and he watched the security team instead. Ash's men looked like a pack of wild dogs ready to go to war over a pork chop. There weren't a lot of Western women in Congo, and certainly not many, if any at all, who looked like Jessica Decker. If Harvath knew that, she had to too, which meant she knew exactly what she was doing. That was fine by him. Some SEALs were notorious for their extracurricular adventures overseas. Why should it be any different for a woman? He knew all too well how hard it could be to maintain a relationship when you spent so much time away from home. Whatever she did with her personal time was her business. As long as it didn't become a distraction, Harvath planned to ignore the whole issue. They ate a good meal, played some more pool, and established a rendezvous time for the morning. Harvath was the first to excuse himself. He had several emails to respond to and wanted to take a shower before turning in. He bought 2 bottles of Primus beer at the bar to go, said goodnight to everyone, and returned to his room. When Harvath walked into the motor court at 4 a.m. that Thursday morning, Ash and his men were already there, loading and inspecting the vehicles. It was cool, only in the low 50s, and had rained heavily during the night. The dirt road outside the hotel had already turned to red mud. As Harvath placed his bag inside the Land Cruiser, designated as LC-1, Dr. Decker appeared beside him. Reaching out, he accepted her pack and placed it inside as well. She smiled and, thanking him, added, "Is there any coffee anywhere?"
"Coffee! Coffee! Yes! Yes!"
said Jumbo, as he stepped out of the hotel with 2 large thermoses.
"Breakfast, too," he stated,
nodding toward a staffer following behind with a hot tray of eggs, rice, and cheese wrapped in non-bread, nuked in the microwave, and then wrapped in foil for the ride. Harvath helped himself to 2. After the vehicle inspections were complete and all the equipment loaded, Ash gave the order to mount up. Once the gates were opened, they splashed out into the road and headed north. Of the 100,000 miles of mapped roads in Congo, less than 2% were actually paved. Of those paved roads, only half were in good condition. In short, traveling anywhere in Congo was an incredible pain in the ass. That went double once you got outside any of its larger towns. The few grass airstrips that existed required constant maintenance, and almost all of those that had been carved from the jungles had been abandoned over the years. Missionaries came and left. Nature always reclaimed what was rightfully hers. In a poverty-stricken country of 70 million, with a landmass the size of the American Midwest, everyone was on the make. This was especially true in the lawless eastern part of Congo, where various rebel factions controlled almost everything. With the average wage about $1 a day and an AK-47 selling for $50, locals got creative fast. That creativity only added to the stress of traversing Congo by car. Ash radioed the brute squad in the Land Cruiser behind them, carrying Jumbo in the cargo.
LC-1 to LC-2. Tollbooth coming up. 50 meters. Everybody stay calm.
All it took was a log, a rope, or a long enough piece of chain, and anyone could establish a toll booth in this part of the country. They were normally staffed by rebel forces, crooked police, or legit military, looking to augment their meager incomes. Some of the impromptu toll booths were said to pull in $700,000 or more a year. It was a racket, to be sure, and the men who ran them ruled the roads with an iron fist. In order to make sure that no one assaulted these setups or tried to blow through without paying, they hid ambush teams farther up the road. Depending on the terrain, sometimes the team was 100 meters ahead, sometimes it was a couple of miles. It was the perfect insurance policy. You might make it past the toll booth without paying, but you had no idea where the ambush team would be. Not only would the ambush team take your life, they would also use your corpse and that of your fellow passengers as an advertisement to others who might think they could avoid paying their fair share. Ash had briefed Harvath and Dr. Decker about his position on the tolls as they rolled out of Bunia. While he hated paying off thugs, $100 for two vehicles was just the cost of doing business in Congo. Despite the coffee and piss-poor roads, Jessica Decker had spent most of the ride sleeping on her rolled-up fleece, pressed against the window. It was a skill likely developed from having experienced multiple war zones and learning to grab sleep whenever you could get it. The key was in knowing when to wake up. As the vehicles came to a stop, she did exactly that.
"What's going on?" she asked.
"Toll," Mick said from the front seat.
"Don't worry. Go back to sleep."
Ash mumbled something under his breath.
"What is it?"
Harvath asked.
"Looks like Congolese regulars," he said. "We'll drop a few bills into the collection plate and be on our way."
As the men up front rolled down their windows, Harvath hoped they were right. But there was something about this setup, something he couldn't put his finger on, that gave him a very bad feeling. Chapter 3. The first soldier who approached their Land Cruiser appeared nervous, distraught. He clutched his AK-47 in both hands.
"Medsa?"
he asked, gesturing with his weapon. "Doctors?" French was the official language of the Democratic Republic of Congo.
"Oui,"
Harvath answered from behind Asher.
"Medsa."
His grade school had been run by an order of French nuns. Next to sports, French had been one of the few things he had excelled at.
"Allez,"
the soldier ordered, grabbing the handle and jerking open Harvath's door.
"Descendez."
"Get out."
"Everyone stays in the vehicles,"
Asher commanded.
"No,"
the soldier said in broken English.
"Doctor, now."
Before anyone could react, Jessica Decker had opened her door and was stepping out.
"Stop,"
Harvath ordered her, but it was too late.
"I'm the doctor,"
Decker stated. The soldier looked back at Harvath.
"Vous n'êtes pas le médecin?"
"You're not the doctor?"
"Moi, je suis."
Decker interrupted Harvath.
"I told you,"
she said, as she grabbed a medical kit from her pack.
"I'm the doctor."
The soldier slammed Harvath's door shut and started walking around to the other side.
"Dr. Decker, I want you back in this vehicle right now,"
Ash instructed through Mick's window. Ash and Mick were both wearing bone phones, earpieces connected to radios hidden under their shirts that transmitted speech through bone conduction technology. Eddie and Simon must have asked for a situation report, because Harvath heard Mick say,
"Figuring that out, no. Stand by."
"Someone needs a doctor," Decker stated with an air of haughtiness. "That's what I do."
"And what I do is keep people safe,"
Ash replied.
"Whoever this someone is, they can wait 5 more minutes while we negotiate this. You're not going anywhere."
"These are soldiers from the Congolese army."
"We don't know that. Now get back in the vehicle."
Decker ignored him and walked forward. He was about to reiterate his order when he heard the door behind him open up and Harvath stepped out. Immediately, the other soldiers raised their weapons. The lead soldier spun and angrily pointed his AK at Harvath.
Que faites-vous? He demanded. What are you doing?
Everybody relax, Decker said, as she put her hands out, appealing for calm. She glared at Harvath. It was a good question. What the hell was he doing? From inside the land cruisers, the Brits were thinking the same thing.
I am the doctor's assistant,
Harvath stated in French, donning a headlamp he had retrieved from his bag. He turned the lamp on and swung his head from side to side, blinding several of the soldiers with its intense glare. They threw their arms up to shield their eyes and cursed him.
If we need a doctor's assistant, the lead soldier barked, we'll call you. Get back in your vehicle.
With that, the man grabbed Jessica Decker by the arm and steered her toward the jungle. Facing a row of angry men with AK-47s, Harvath did the only thing he could do at the moment. Reluctantly, he climbed back into the land cruiser.
She's insane, Ash stated.
Harvath had already developed his own opinion about Decker, but now wasn't the time to discuss it.
Look at their shoes, he said.
The SAS men did as he suggested.
None of their boots match. Two of them are wearing tennis shoes.
Ash cursed under his breath.
The uniforms may be from the Congolese army, but these guys definitely aren't.
So who are they? Mick wondered. Harvath nodded at the two rebels closest to them.
Both of them, as well as the guy Dr. Decker just walked off with, have the same tattoo. Looks like a cobra.
Shit,
Ash replied.
Rebels.
FRPI. There were so many rebel groups in Congo, it was hard to tell the players without a scorecard. Harvath had uploaded a list of them to his phone before leaving, and had tried to study up as much as he could on the flight over.
Free Republic of, he attempted before Mick interrupted him. Front for Patriotic Resistance of Ituri, he said, looking at the uniformed men. Based out of Bunia. I've never heard any reports of them being along this road, much less posing as Congolese regulars. They must be desperate for cash.
They were desperate for something, Harvath thought.
How bad is this group?
The FRPI? Pretty bad. Rape, mass murder, drugs, you name it. But the tattoo's the problem. These guys are a unit of shock troops. Kind of like a Republican Guard. They do everything from protecting high-ranking FRPI leadership to terrorizing civilians.
Which probably explains why they're out here with an injured patient and not back at the hospital in Bunia. This is not going to end well.
We don't know that, Mick offered.
Listen, these rebels just hit the jackpot. They not only now have a doctor, they have a very attractive female doctor. They're not going to give her back. That goes double if whoever needs the medical care is a high-ranking rebel with a price on his head.
What if you're wrong?
Mick asked with his eyes focused on the rebels.
What if I'm not? Said Harvath.
Then they're going to want to get rid of us, Ash stated.
We're already outgunned. All they have to do is bury our bodies and torch the trucks. Wouldn't be the first time it had happened in Congo, right?
No, particularly not where the FRPI is concerned.
So, the longer we sit here, Harvath continued, the worse our odds get. At some point soon, an order is going to come over that radio, and they're going to open fire on us. We need to get off the X right now. What kind of weapons do we have?
Torch the trucks. Get off the X. What kind of weapons do we have?
Who the hell are you?
Mick demanded as he turned around to face him.
I'm the client.
Ash studied Harvath in the rearview mirror, and Harvath met his gaze. Alpha dogs always recognized another alpha when they saw one. He was no ordinary client. They had known that from the moment they first met him. Harvath couldn't keep them completely in the dark. If they were going to get out of this alive, they were going to have to work together. He would have to give them something.
Care sent me to assess the situation, he said. They want to open two more facilities in Congo.
What kind of assessment?
Security.
And your background?
SEAL Team 2, and then DEVGRU.
Ash continued to hold Harvath's gaze. Finally, he said,
You look it.
Harvath didn't know what the remark was supposed to mean. Before he could reply, Ash said,
We've got two Glock 17s up front with us, and there's a shotgun under your seat.
Can I get to it without flipping it up?
No. Besides, it's too loud. There's no telling how many more of them are up the road or out in the jungle. We just draw them in.
And the Glocks won't? Harvath asked.
Ash nodded to Mick, who pointed over Harvath's shoulder and said, There's a box of car parts behind you. Inside are two inline fuel filters. They've been modified with a thread adapter to screw onto the Glocks.
Homemade suppressors. Smart.
What else do you have?
The Brute Squad have Glocks, as well as rifles, Ash replied.
What kind of rifles?
AKs, like our friends outside.
Can you slip me your Glocks without them noticing?
Mick turned his shaved head back around and focused on the soldiers. Slowly, he began to work his pistol between the seat and the center console. Ash then did the same. Careful not to draw any attention, Harvath reached behind his seat and felt for the box of car parts. Once he found it, he removed the two filters. He also grabbed the extra medical bag.
What are you thinking? Ash asked.
Harvath began screwing the makeshift suppressors onto each of the Glocks.
See the third soldier on the left, he said, the one with the dirty bandage around his left hand. That dressing probably hasn't been changed in a while, if at all. I think that's our best chance to get me close to them.
And?
I get him into your headlights to examine his hand. If I can, I enlist two of his comrades to help. Give them stuff to hold and keep them busy. When I give you the signal, you flip on your high beams, I pull one of the Glocks, and we go hot. Anything driver's side is mine.
And Mick takes out the rest.
Harvath nodded.
What about the others? We have no idea how many more are out there.
We'll jump off that bridge when we come to it.
Ash thought about it for a second.
What do you want to use for your signal?
Harvath slid Mick's pistol back to him, removing some items from the medical bag so he could stash the remaining suppressed Glock. He took out a penlight. Cupping his hand around it to hide the beam, he checked to make sure it worked.
When you see me pull out the penlight, watch for two quick flashes. Once that happens, wait 10 seconds, then hit your high beams and come out firing.
That's it?
That's it, said Harvath.
Ash quietly radioed the plan to the Brute Squad. Once they had acknowledged, he looked at Harvath in the rearview mirror and nodded. It was time to roll. Chapter 4. The moment Harvath popped the Land Cruiser's door open and climbed out, the soldiers began shouting at him to get back in. Keeping a smile on his face, he ignored their commands. Instead, he moved toward them. The medical bag was slung over one shoulder, and in his arms he cradled an assortment of supplies. Nodding toward the soldier with the bandaged hand, he offered to change his dressing in exchange for being allowed to step off the road and relieve himself afterward. One soldier in particular raised his rifle as if he was about to strike Harvath, but the man with a bandaged hand told him to stop. He needed his dressing changed, badly. Harvath stepped into the beams cast by the Land Cruiser's headlights and motioned the man to him. Once he was there, Harvath convinced two more to join him and assist. Slinging their rifles, they accepted the supplies and did what Harvath asked. Even lightly touching the man's bandaged hand caused him to wince. He was in considerable pain. Harvath could see that the wound was oozing. It was infected. As he carefully unwound the bandage, he asked the young man how he had been injured. The soldier, who couldn't have been more than 19 or 20, explained that his hand had slipped while using his machete. Congolese rebels could be horrific butchers. Harvath didn't want to know the details. The wound was a week old, and another soldier had dressed it for him. The bandage hadn't been changed. As soon as Harvath had it unwound, the stench alone told him the man's hand was a lost cause.
Is it very bad?
The young soldier asked in French. Holding the man by the wrist, Harvath rotated the hand from side to side.
We need more light, he said, moving the soldier farther away from the group.
Gesturing with his head, he encouraged the other two to move with them. They did. Once he had them where he needed them, he pretended to examine the wound once more, and then told the man's compatriots what he needed them to do. Explaining that they had limited disinfectant, he told one man he would need to pour it over the top of the wound, while the other man held a clean dressing underneath to catch the liquid as it poured down. They would then wring the bandage out over the wound to give it a second cleansing. As men who led lives of unfathomable paucity, reusing the liquid made complete sense to them. In order to keep their attention focused on the wound and off of him, Harvath further instructed them to watch for any indication that the discharge was changing color. Harvath had his patient, as well as his two assistants, squat down so they could all work better via the Land Cruiser's headlights. One of the men became agitated when he saw him reach into his medical bag and demanded to know what he was doing. Harvath held out the penlight and showed it to him. Satisfied, the rebel returned his focus to his colleague's wound. Taking one last look around and fixing everyone's position in his mind, Harvath instructed the man with the disinfectant to very slowly start pouring it over the wound and reminded the man holding the dressing underneath to make sure he caught every last drop. Standing up straight, he moved the penlight to his left hand and held it where Ash and Mick would be the only ones able to see it. Then, sliding his right hand into the medical bag, he wrapped it around the butt of his weapon and took a deep breath. Exhaling, he depressed the light's tail cap, giving out two quick flashes as he began to count backward from 10. When the Land Cruiser's high beams kicked on, Harvath already had the suppressed Glock free of the bag and his finger applying pressure to its trigger. The three rebels next to him were stacked almost like a totem pole, with one head on top of another. Harvath started with the man who was pouring the disinfectant and worked his way down. Three headshots in less than 2 seconds. Before the bodies had even crumpled to the ground, Harvath had his weapon up and trained on the remaining soldiers. Mick, though, had been just as deadly. All of his shots had found their marks. Nevertheless, Harvath moved over to them to make sure they were dead. They were. The Brits joined him and quickly helped secure the scene. After stripping the dead rebels of their weapons, ammunition, and soul radio, which they gave to an amazingly unperturbed Jumbo to monitor, they tossed the bodies in the jungle on the opposite side of the road. Life in Africa, and especially Congo, was exceedingly cheap. "How do you want to handle Dr. Decker?" Ash asked. Harvath had never wanted her along in the first place. After what she had done, part of him wanted to leave her here, but he couldn't do that. He knew he was going to have to be the one to get her out. He also knew that Murphy, of the eponymous law, loved Africa more than any other country in the world. If it could go wrong, it would go wrong, especially in Africa. That went double for Congo. Looking at the weapons they had taken off of the dead soldiers, two options popped into Harvath's mind. A cigar roll or a picket fence. In the cigar roll, he'd stagger Ash and his men along a route between the road and wherever Jessica Decker was. Once he had her and they were making their escape, the shooters would give them cover and then join them in their retreat, rolling the cigar as they worked backward toward the vehicles. But that was one of the spots where Mr. Murphy would be waiting with the vehicles. They needed to keep the Land Cruisers running and ready to go. There was no telling how many rebels they might have on their tail as they tore through the jungle. It would be a death sentence to arrive at the road and discover that something had happened to their only means of ultimate escape. They couldn't risk leaving the vehicles. Judging by the little he knew about Ash, the Brit wouldn't like Harvath's plan. Ash was a good man, a soldier. He'd want to go into the jungle too, but Harvath couldn't ask him to do that. It wasn't right. Not with how much had already been kept from him and his team. Harvath decided to go with the picket. Chapter 5. Ash looked at Harvath in disbelief.
"That's got to be the dumbest thing I have ever heard. Four blokes from the regiment, four, and you want us to mind the car park? Are you out of your tree?"
"It's a SEAL thing," Harvath responded. "Don't take it personally."
"The hell it is.
You have no idea what's waiting for you in there. If it goes pear-shaped, you're going to need backup.
Give me a radio, he replied. If anything happens, I'll call you.
Sure you will, Superman, Ash said as he walked away to get a radio.
Bloody Americans.
Even though Ash didn't like it, the picket was the right way to do this, and he knew it. Harvath walked over and checked on Simon and Eddie. It was amazing how fast they moved. He could almost sense a rivalry between the two as they field-stripped the dead rebels' AK-47s, wiped everything down, and rapidly reassembled them. Lives depended on those weapons working, specifically the lives of Scott Harvath and Jessica Decker. Mick duct-taped magazines together so that all Harvath would have to do was spin a spent mag upside down in order to reinsert a fresh one. He knew, though, that if Harvath needed a second mag for any of these weapons, it was because he was in more trouble than a second mag was likely to ever help him get out of.
Here's your radio, Ash said, handing it to him. Don't be afraid to use it.
I won't,
Harvath replied, as he worked the bone microphone into his ear. After a quick commo check, Harvath pocketed a stack of loaded Glock mags and shouldered 6 AK-47s. It was a rough load, but he had humped worse. It would get lighter as he got closer to Decker. Better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it.
You'll want these, too, Ash remarked, as he gave him a handful of mini chemical light sticks.
Harvath thanked him, and without another word, turned and headed off in the direction Dr. Decker had been led into the jungle. The great thing about the British SAS was that they viewed war the same way the American Special Operations community did. You didn't win by thinking inside the box and following someone else's rules. You turned the box upside down and made your own rules, no matter what the enemy threw at you. Just as they had found a way to suppress their Glocks, they had also found a way to lay their hands on a pair of night vision goggles. As Harvath picked his way through the jungle's total darkness with them, he was thankful for the team's ingenuity. Using a flashlight would have been like taking out a billboard telling the bad guys he was coming and when he was going to be there. With what he had planned, he preferred that they not have any advance notice. Surprise was one of the things he needed to keep on his side. Though it wasn't raining, it might as well have been. Everything was damp, and drops of water continued to roll off the heavy tree canopy high above. The rainforests of the Congo Basin contained so much water that they caused their own weather system and were known as the lungs of Africa. Harvath had operated in plenty of jungles, and he had never liked any of them. He hated humidity. He preferred the high desert. High altitude and cold were his favorites. Jungles were just plain dangerous. You not only had to worry about bad guys, but everything else lurking out there that wanted to eat you too. Then there was the orchestra of noise, one sound layered upon the next. There was so much of it, it was hard to think, much less listen for any indication of danger. You had no way of knowing if what you had heard was 5 yards away or 5 inches. That went double in the dark. The path Dr. Do-Gooder and the lead soldier had taken was pretty well trampled and easy to follow. As Harvath positioned his first AK and marked its hiding spot with one of the mini chem lights, his mind was taken up by how pissed off he was at Decker. She had placed her ideology over her instincts. Harvath, who was all instinct, had seen her type before. It never ended well for them. And in a conflict zone, it all too often ended very badly for the people around them. He had no intention of letting that happen here. As he worked his way deeper into the jungle, he continued to hide rifles and leave chem lights along the way. What he wouldn't have given for a ruck full of claymores, but it was much better than nothing. The problem with spacing out the rifles was that he had no idea how far in he would have to go. It was all based on his gut. As he was about to place the last one, he began to hear voices. Every muscle in his body tensed, and he stood absolutely still, his ears straining to not only discern what they were saying, but also to determine how far away they were and if they were moving in his direction. Quietly, he stepped off the path and crouched down. His suppressed Glock was pulled in tight to his chest, his finger on the trigger, ready to fire. Seconds felt like minutes. Drops of water thudded onto him as well as the broad leaves of the plants all around him. It sounded like rain hitting a canvas awning. It made it difficult to hear anything else. As best he could tell, there were two voices, both men, and they were coming closer. He slowly began to apply pressure to his trigger. By the time they were close enough to be intelligible, they were almost on top of him. Whatever language they were speaking, he didn't recognize it. They were walking in single file and appeared to be alone. There was no one else on the path. Harvath discharged his weapon, and a muffled spit accompanied each of the two rounds as they ripped through moist air and found their targets. The lifeless bodies collapsed onto the wet vegetation, each with a dime-sized hole near the bridge of their nose. Any sound made by the clatter of their equipment was gobbled up by the cacophony of the jungle. Stripping them of their weapons, he then dragged them far enough off the path that they wouldn't be noticed until daylight, which unfortunately was fast approaching. Stepping back onto the path, he pushed on. Soon enough, he found what he was looking for. The sentry was 40 meters out. He dispatched him the same way he had the others, and moved the body. There were no other defenses he could see between him and the small encampment. Circling around to the west, he counted three canvas tents. There were no fires. It was a cold camp. They obviously didn't want to attract any notice. For several moments, he did nothing but listen, trying to figure out which of the tents Decker might be in. The drops began falling harder, and he realized that it was now raining. From somewhere, there was a rumble of thunder. If he was lucky, the storm might hold back the daylight and help keep the rebels in their tents. There was no logic to picking which one to check first. She could have been in any one of them. He decided to work from right to left. Just as he was about to step out of the bush, something caught his eye. Tripwire. Backing away, he traced it to its source. It was a crude but deadly anti-personnel device that had been fashioned by running a length of paracord to the pin of a hand grenade, which itself had been secured to a tree trunk. Without any chem lights left, there was no way to mark it. Carefully, he stepped over the cord and slipped into the camp. The rain was coming down hard enough to mask the sound of his movement, even to his own ears. He could only imagine it sounded twice as loud for anyone inside the tents. He approached the first one and listened as the rain beat upon the canvas.